Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. In early June, we spoke with Carrie Brown, the executive director of the Vermont Commission on Women. Just as the Leaders for Equity and Equal Pay, or LEAP, toolkit was being launched. We've invited Carrie back on the program this morning in order to get an update on how that toolkit has been incorporated by businesses, but also to discuss some other key issues affecting women in Vermont. During this segment, we'll talk about the pandemic's continued impact on women, equal pay for black women, and affordable child care. Carrie Brown, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Great to have you. Now, listeners, if you want to ask Carrie about the work of the commission, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Carrie, let's pick up where we left off with LEAP. First of all, can you explain what this toolkit is?
Sure. This is a free toolkit for employers to use to assess their pay equity situation. So it's designed specifically for small to medium-sized employers, like up to 400 employees. And it's an Excel-based tool plus a really comprehensive playbook, we call it, that explains how to use it and how to assess equal pay and what that really is. And it's a way for businesses to look at their employees and to look at their pay structure and to see if there are any kind of hidden inequities in there. It's not our assumption is that we don't have employers in Vermont who are intentionally paying women less than they're paying men or paying people of color less than they're paying white people. But these inequities can kind of creep in because there's so much structural inequity in our society that sometimes businesses can find that they are perpetuating some unfairness without even realizing it. And so this is a toolkit. It lets you put in how much your employees are making, how many years they've been working, the pay range, and stuff like that. That does, it's, you know, complicated analysis that's beyond me, which is why it's great that it's in a toolkit. You don't have to think about it. And it lets you know kind of where you are. And then the playbook is this accompanying document that's very comprehensive explanation of sort of how these things can come to exist and then what can be done about it. So what you can do if you find out that you have some inequities, or if you don't, you know, things that you can do to make sure that you've got the best system in place so that none of them ever pop up and so that you're really making sure that everybody has great opportunities in your business.
Do you have any idea of how many Vermont organizations have downloaded and started using LEAP?
Well, we know that over 250 people have downloaded it.
Wow.
And so, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And it's primarily Vermont, but we are also getting some people from elsewhere who are downloading it, which is great because it was designed with Vermont employers in mind in terms of the size, because we have mostly small and mid-sized employers. But, of course, anybody anywhere could use it.
What feedback have you received from these companies and organizations about how they've been able to integrate it?
Well, we have some pretty detailed information from the group of companies that were kind of the guinea pigs on this, mm-hmm. that helped pilot this. And so they completed the whole thing. They've been through it. They actually also did a full year-long program where they met with each other and had some real in-depth discussion and some training about it. And they have found that it's been incredibly useful. You know, they've been able to uncover some things that they didn't quite realize were there. They've been able to get some ideas for things that they can put into place, such as looking at their promotion schedules, looking at their recruiting practices, looking at their workplace practices, things like flexible work arrangements and that sort of thing that can help to really make sure that everybody has an opportunity to succeed.
And from your perspective, Carrie, why is this tool important for organizations to incorporate?
Well, it's really important because there are so many things that can impact how people are compensated and the fairness behind it that aren't directly caused necessarily by the employers that they're working for, mm-hmm. but that can be addressed by those employers. So, for instance, if a man and woman get out of college at the same time, same major, and no experience, we can see that there's already a wage gap, on average, that happens, that women are making a little bit less money out of the gate. And so then when you look at what happens over the course of a career, promotions and raises and all of that, they just compound so that man who's getting paid more 10 years later, 15 years later, the difference is even greater. And so then when they come into, say, my company, I'm an employer and I bring them both in, if I were to, for instance, pay them based on what they made at their last job, then, and give them a 5% raise above that, for instance, which sounds like a good deal, you're getting more money. But because that difference is already there, that had been built in over the 10 or 15 years of their career, then I'm just continuing that. I'm just perpetuating that. Mm-hmm. And so to have some awareness of that, and so to instead look at what does the job actually require, what are the education requirements, and what's that job actually worth, rather than how much the people were getting paid before, then I can pay them in a way that's fair and equitable.
While we're on the subject of equal pay for women, Tuesday was Black Women's Equal Pay Day. How big is the pay gap for Black women in the country?
Well, so Equal Pay Day is the symbolic day that we talk about that shows how far into the following year women have to work, make as much money as men made the year before. Uh-huh. And so on average, if you look at how much all women are making and how much all men are making, then that average day this year was March 24th. Mm-hmm. But if you break it down a little bit more and you look at, so for instance, Black women have to work until August 3rd to make the same amount of money that white men made the year before. And so they're making about 63 cents on the dollar. And when you look at other groups too, they fall at different times in the year. The latest one that we have seen is Latino women, which isn't until October 21st. They make 55 cents for every dollar that white men make.
Wow. So there's the problem. How does that get solved? How does that wage gap, which is immense right now, get closed?
Yeah, there are a lot of causes of it, and so there have to be a lot of ways to try to address it. A big part of it is the kinds of jobs that women and men tend to do. So women tend to be concentrated in jobs that pay less. They tend to be more in caregiving professions, so personal aides, childcare, teachers, those kinds of things, and men tend to be concentrated in jobs that pay more, such as engineering. And when you look at the overall wages that are paid in those fields, we see a huge difference. And so we need to think about this in two ways. One is, why is it that we have this idea that there are some jobs that are just sort of more suited for men and some jobs that are more suited for women? Mm-hmm. That's a sort of a weird idea when you stop and think about it. But then the other thing is, why do we have some jobs that pay so much less, that we value so much less with money, even though their value to our society and to our economy is absolutely essential? So during the pandemic, we heard all kinds of talk about essential workers. Mm-hmm. And I love that term because it really tells us this is what all of us need. We all need certain people to be doing their jobs for everything else to work. And so something like childcare, that's one of those essential jobs. None of us can, our whole economy cannot function without somebody taking care of the children. And whether that's people taking care of them in their own homes, unpaid, or whether it's them paying someone to take care of them in childcare, or it's public pre-K programs, somehow this has to get paid for. And I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent now.
That's all right. This is good.
but that we don't have, we don't value that. We call it essential, but then we don't value it with the pay. Child care workers, for instance, are some of the lowest paid workers that we have. And I think nobody would dispute that it's some of the absolute most important work that we need done. So there's just that disconnect there. And so that's a big part of what we have to really wrestle with as a society, is how we value different kinds of work.
Carrie, the pandemic is the next topic I'd like to discuss. We're in that gray area right now where it feels like we're out of the pandemic, especially here in Vermont. But we know that with the Delta variant, that the rest of the country, to say nothing, the rest of the world, still ensconced in this pandemic. And one thing we know for sure is women are still feeling the effects of the pandemic. What are those effects? How have women been affected by the pandemic?
Well, women were, at the beginning of this, were overrepresented in the kinds of jobs that were most affected by the pandemic. So, for instance, things like food service and personal care and retail and those kinds of things, the jobs that went away first and have been having the hardest time coming back. So that was a big impact right away. And then when schools closed and child cares closed, it was mostly women who found themselves with the added responsibility of taking care of the children who were now at home. And that's really just because that was true all along. So there was already a really disproportionate burden of family care and home responsibilities on women's shoulders. That's just one of those inequities that we were talking about before that's really kind of built into our society. And so that, which also has a lot to do with the wage gap. One of the many reasons for the wage gap is women are more likely to work part-time, more likely to take time off, more likely to work in jobs where they work less hours. And so when suddenly all the children were home, that really played into that. And so we saw more women leaving their jobs in order to take on more of the child responsibilities. We saw more women just completely leave the workforce altogether. You know, lots of people were unemployed, and more women than men were unemployed. But then even more women than men just decided, forget it, it's too much to juggle, I'm not even going to try anymore, and just left the workforce completely. And we, in fact, nationwide, seen women's workforce levels have gone down to what they were in the late 80s.
Oh my.
And so it's an incredible setback of all the progress that women have been making over the years. Decades worth of progress undone practically overnight.
And how long does it take to bounce back from something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that really remains to be seen. And, you know, as everybody knows, the things aren't just bouncing back in terms of what the workforce in general looks like, right? We have more people who are opting not to take low-wage jobs right now. They've been out of work for a while, and they've been doing different things, and they're not really interested in going back to a poorly paid job with no benefits and no flexibility. And so I think that right there, that dynamic, is going to have some permanent impact on the way employment looks in the future. I don't know exactly how that's going to go, but it's already having that effect. And in terms of what's going to happen with women, I mean, I can't really make any real predictions, but I can tell you, looking at the unemployment figures, we've been tracking the share of unemployment in Vermont that's women and that's men. And, you know, normally we see a greater percentage of the people who are on unemployment being men. That's typical in Vermont. It's typical nationwide. Across the country, that changed during the pandemic. So we saw a greater proportion of those people were women. But it's been much higher in Vermont than it has been nationally. And it's kind of steadied out at the national level. It's kind of shaken back down to about 50-50, which is still not exactly typical. But in Vermont, we're still seeing this difference. It's been the share of people on unemployment in Vermont who are women has been about 60% since January. It was higher than that for a while, and it came down. But we've been really lodged since, you know, March, April, May, June have all been right around 60%. And they're a little bit higher in January and February. But so it's not changing now that we're, you know, supposedly coming out of the pandemic. That part isn't really changing, which is interesting to me. And I don't know exactly what that tells us about the future, except that this isn't a situation that's going to change quickly.
Yeah. Let's take a call now from Jack, who's joining us from Moscow. Hi, Jack. Go right ahead.
Yes. I've heard this debate a lot, and it always seems to me to be coming from a little bit of an economic class bias. I rarely hear anything about, for lack of a better word, the traditional hardworking laborers who work through decades of pain and wind up with problems like problems with their joints and their bodies and their carriages. And they get to be about 50 or 60, and it's really, really difficult for a lot of these guys you see on roofs and ladders and things like that. And there doesn't seem to be any consideration or gauge of what's happening to the people who literally work themselves to the point of disabilities, but keep on going. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I've worked with them.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be a forgotten part of the argument. And I'll hang up and I'll listen, ma'am. Thank you.
All right, Jack. Thanks so much for the call. Carrie?
Well, that is a great point.
Yeah.
For me, it's making me think about what this dynamic we're seeing happening now of people being a little bit reluctant to go back to work in these jobs that are not really such great jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the kind of thing that I think people are probably looking at. Like, I can work my fingers to the bone, just about literally, and then where am I going to end up at the end? You know, am I going to be able to, if I can't work after I'm 50 because I've worked in this high demanding job, then can I retire at 50? No, you can't retire at 50. But so that's the kind of job that I'm hoping that we will really begin to look at. How do we value that kind of work? You know, my great-grandfather died of black lung disease because he was a coal miner when he had when he was very, very young. And that's a sort of a cliche now, and we all think, oh, well, yes, that's so terrible. You know, we don't do that anymore. But this caller has pointed out that we do kind of do that. We might be working people to a slower early end. And, so I agree. This is a huge concern, and I hope that we will be thinking about the value of work, and that's the kind of thing that needs to be factored in when you think about how much is this labor actually worth.
Carrie, as a matter of fact, I had a great example Monday morning. I had a woman in here, Maggie Mae Anderson, who had been doing massage therapy for over 20 years and still fairly young. And had to, you know, say, I can't continue to do this. If I want to open up a jar, when I'm, you know, 55 or 60. And so she's shifted to something, you know, she's doing stretch therapy. And it's going to be less taxing on her body. But she had to think about that now before, like Jack said, she gets to her late 50s, into her 60s. And cannot continue. So, I do want to touch, we only have a few minutes left, on childcare, something you brought up about the pay, but the cost of childcare is something that's been a bit debilitating in Vermont. And so, you know, we're seeing people return to the office, childcare becomes important again. So, you know, these costs for childcare seem to be out of a lot of people's reach, forcing some people to have to stay home. The relief from March's stimulus package, the subsidy for up to $300 per child, is that helping parents in Vermont bridge that gap?
I think that it's a huge help to some parents who are really at the bottom of the income scale. It's tremendously helpful and essential. I think when you're looking at the cost of childcare over the course of a year, it's not enough to really make a huge difference if somebody can't afford childcare. I'm pleased with the legislature having put more money into the Child Care Financial Assistance Program, but there's a long way to go. And it's kind of a simple math problem that you look at how much money parents have to put in to paying for childcare and how much childcare costs, and they don't add up. You know, there's not enough money in parents' pockets to be able to cover that. And that is even with paying childcare providers really, you know, unconscionably low wages. So if we were going to pay them the wages that they deserve, there's absolutely no way that individual parents are going to be able to cover the cost of that. And so we really have to rethink how we pay for childcare in general. And it's going to take some much broader thinking, I believe.
Yeah. Carrie, we have about a minute left. The other thing I want to make sure we hit is paid family and medical leave. It was passed by the legislature, I believe, January of last year, vetoed by Governor Scott. Where does that stand in the future of Vermont?
Well, there's good reason for hope that there may be some action at the federal level. We may have a federal paid family and medical leave program coming along. So that's what I'm feeling very hopeful and optimistic about. And that would be a much better solution than individual states trying to take it on themselves, because, you know, there's a matter of how to pay for this, and it makes a lot more sense to have a much larger pool of people who are all paying a little bit of money into this, so that everybody can benefit. So that's my hope, is that that will happen.
Carrie Brown is the executive director of the Vermont Commission on Women. To learn more about their work and their mission, you can visit women.vermont.gov. Carrie, always great having you on the program. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. We're going to get a CBS News update next. Then we're going to make a couple stops in the NEK. And first, we're going to learn about something called Rinktoberfest. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. In the more rural areas of the state, it can be difficult to provide the necessary facilities for residents to have the same opportunities as those in our more urban areas. And that can be especially true for athletic facilities where the population is spread out. It's why I love to hear about community ski hills like Northeast Slopes in East Corinth or Hardack in St. Albans. In Lindenville, the Fenton Chester Arena is one of those places that provides opportunities for skaters young and old to get some ice time and for the community to come together. When the ice comes up, it can be used for lacrosse, soccer, baseball and softball, as a rain site for graduations and so many more things. I think I might have even attended a roller derby match there at the Fenton Chester Arena. But right now, the building needs some love, and a group has gotten together to raise some funds for the arena. Here to tell us about what's happening in Lindenville is one of the organizers of something called Rinktoberfest, Matt Young. Matt, it's great to have you on the show. We're dying to find out about Rinktoberfest.
Well, thank you and good morning, everybody. Thanks for having us on this morning. We're putting together a auction event to raise funds for the Fest Arena in Linden. The event will be Saturday, September 25th at 6. We're going to have live and silent auctions, appetizers, cash bar, and a lot of fun. So it's going to be similar. We've done a fundraising auction for Linden area youth hockey for a number of years, and we're going to try to go off and but make it maybe even a little bigger. There's certainly a need, and we want to keep this rink going.
Oh, that's great. Well, tell us about the rink itself, the Fenton Chester Arena.
Aging rink, a lot of history. The rink certainly has given a lot of people an opportunity to skate and play ice hockey. And without it, you're an hour away for any other ice skating facility, and a lot of people just wouldn't be able to play. The rink is aging. The what we need right away is somewhere around $88,000. The town has agreed to spend $25,000 to repair and make some improvements, mechanical systems, the roof, et cetera. And we're certainly happy for that. There's around $63,000 needed for the Zamboni ice-making plant, and that's just to cover the initial startup costs and also for insurance, utilities, and staffing. It's been $40,000 raised so far, for, mostly through a GoFundMe page.
Wow, that's a great start. That the 40, and is that with the 25, or in addition to the 25 from the town?
The 40 is in addition to the 25.
Well done, Matt, and everyone there doing the work for the Fenton Chester Arena. If I remember correctly, they have great cheeseburgers there too, don't they, at the snack bar?
Absolutely.
I thought so.
Yeah. Linden Institute has run the facility for several years. And unfortunately, it's been at a deficit because the rink is getting to the point where it's costly and it needs significant repairs most every year.
Yeah.
I think in the long term, probably there will be a new rink somewhere. You hear rumors. But we really can't afford to have no rent for a year or two or three, so we need to keep this open and keep it operating.
Matt, what's your interest in the arena?
Well, I played hockey many, many years ago. I started late, and back then when you started late, you became goalie. I developed a passion for it, loved it, played in high school, played on several men's league teams, and then I played for the Vermont State Police. They needed a goaltender. And I met some just wonderful people and lifelong friends. All three of my children have skated at the rink. My son is off to college in the fall. And my youngest daughter now plays for the Vermont Flames travel team. Hmm. But she may be coming back and playing high school hockey here. There's an opportunity and a place to do so.
Matt, are the Bruins and Habs still scouting you, or were they scared off by your exorbitant salary demands?
They said something about I was enjoying too many cheeseburgers. So I'm not sure they're going to be calling anytime soon.
All right. So Matt does not have a professional ice hockey career, but he does have a career in being an auctioneer, and we'll talk about that a little later. But still focusing on the Fenton Chester Arena, how wide a geographic area does the arena serve?
Well, basically, it's three counties, which make up, I think it's something like 20% of Vermont's land. Thousands and thousands of people that they have to travel so far, and we wouldn't be able to book ice anywhere else at an appropriate time. I mean, you don't want an 8-year-old driving, the parents driving them 2 hours away or an hour and a half away and skating at 10 o'clock at night.
Right.
So this is really a unique situation, and we really need to keep this place open. So we're just trying to do what we can to get it up and running. We will, and it will run and operate this year. There's tremendous support, and our immediate need and what we're asking for is for people who make items, they always seem to sell well at the auction. So if somebody is a carpenter, maybe they make a bookcase, or somebody makes jewelry or some type of art, a rug, a quilt, really anything that we can sell at the auction. And so we're asking, that's our immediate need, because there's plenty of time between now and the event. So we're asking if people would make things for us, and it would be a big help.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about ice time. I think anyone who's ever played hockey or has had children who played hockey or are figure skaters know that ice time can be at a premium even when there is a local rink. If that goes away, the demands get even worse. Now, you're looking for items for people to donate for Ringtoberfest. Where do they go? How do they contact you or someone involved with the event to get those items to you?
Well, probably the best way would be if I left an email address.
Okay.
And my email is Matt Young, M-A-T-T-Y-O-U-N-G, sells, S-E-L-L-S, at gmail.com.
So okay.
Matt Young sells at gmail.com. And anything that somebody could make, or if someone has a business, we are asking for new or handmade items.
Mm-hmm. Now, Matt, where did this idea for Ringtoberfest come from?
Well, there was a couple of us who wanted to do something. Adrienne DiOlimpio, who is a wonderful in the community, she's done a tremendous amount for Powers Park and a number of other organizations, charitable causes. She had this idea of some type of an event, and I got together and spoke with her and some of the people on the Rink board. And we've done the youth hockey auction for 20 years, so it seemed like a natural thing to maybe go into this.
Mm-hmm. And I think you had a little organizational meeting earlier this week. You getting people to join on and help with Ringtoberfest?
Yes, we sure are. We had probably 20 people show up this last week, and we started to work on some of our initial tests and timelines. There's a tremendous amount of work involved with these things, and having a good group of volunteers certainly makes the burden a little less on everybody. So there seemed to be a lot of support and enthusiasm, and we just have to stay organized, and hopefully the items will come in. We believe we will have a good crowd there, and we need some nice things to sell.
And what's the date of Ringtoberfest again?
It's September 25th. It's going to be held right in the Fenton Chester Arena itself at 6 o'clock.
All right. September 25th at the arena, 6 o'clock. And if you've got items for the auction, Matt Young Sells, S-E-L-L-S, at gmail.com. Matt, just want to go over the numbers again that you mentioned, trying to raise a total of $88,000. $25,000 came from the town. You've already, this group has put together GoFundMe page, $40,000. So $23,000 left to go. They've really got some great forward momentum. Tell people again what will happen and when at Ringtoberfest.
Ringtoberfest is going to be a really fun night. We're going to have a live and silent auctions, appetizers, cash bar, and with some surprises. We'll do some giveaways and maybe some different raffles and that type of thing. But it's obviously a big open building, and I think people just want to get out and get together and maybe have some sense of normalcy. And what a great way for the community to come together. And we've seen support. It's really heartwarming. Hockey families from other organizations far away. Mm. In fact, the Stowe Hockey Organization, it actually brought a tear to my eye. They sent a check for $500 to this effort. What an amazing group the hockey people are out there in the world. They really come together and support one another. The culture and the people, there's nothing like it.
And that is going to be Saturday, September 25th at the arena itself. 6 o'clock is when it starts. If you've got items that they can use in the auction, you said new or hand-built, you can email Matt Young Sells, S-E-L-L-S, at gmail.com. Matt, do you ever get tired of saying the made-up word Ringtoberfest?
No. It was Adrian's idea, and once she mentioned it, the entire group said, wow, we love it. Ringtoberfest, we're looking forward to this being the first of many. We would like to do it year after year, and I think it can be a great thing every fall that we do.
So since you made this up, this thing has potential to develop into a huge gathering, an annual event to support the arena and keep it going?
That's correct. Yes.
Now, how can area, like NEK businesses, get involved and help out with what you're doing?
Well, there's also going to be some sponsorships of the event. So there's some people going around to various businesses and that could potentially be maybe larger donors and asking them to write a check to underwrite and support our event, because we will have some expense, some advertising and different things like that. So everyone will be approached, or there's we've been pretty active on Facebook, or they could email me directly if they would like to.
And you've probably been kicking around some idea of how many people you'd like to see show up for Ringtoberfest on the 25th of September. What kind of figures, how many people do you think you might get there at the arena that night?
We are really hoping for 300 to 400 people.
Mm-hmm.
There's room, and it would be wonderful if there's 5. But we think there's tremendous support. This rink has served the community well. A lot of people were able to skate here and play, and without this rink, they certainly wouldn't have had the opportunity to do so.
Matt, we mentioned that for a living you are an auctioneer. And how did you get into the auction business in the first place?
Well, I was a little kid, and I worked for another auctioneer, and Roger Lucher, in fact, who was an auction legend,
mm-hmm.
and I used to carry boxes out to the crowd when I was a little kid, and I looked up one day, and Roger was standing on a hay trailer, and there was all kinds of people gathered around, and I'll never forget, he had a long brown leather jacket, and he had the command and the attention of everyone, and I looked up, and I knew then that's what I wanted to do. So,
how do you train to be an auctioneer?
Practice. There are auction schools, but I did auctions for several years, and then I went out to Missouri to an auction school, but just a lot of practice.
All right, and that night there's going to be live auction and silent auction. Are you going to do a little auctioning even on the silent auction side? I've had to do that once.
Probably not. No, I think they generally will take care of themselves, I hope. But we'll have, I'll guess we'll have around 75 items in the live auction section, and then probably several hundred in the silent auction area, we hope.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot, Matt, and ask you to give us just a little sample of your auctioneering style. Give us a taste.
Yeah, 25 of them are 30, 9 of them are 30, 5 of them are 40, 40, 45 of them are 5 of them are 50, 55 of them are 60.
Oh, my gosh, that was great. And I owe $60 just like that.
Yeah, plus there's going to be a premium on top of that.
Oh, my gosh. I knew there was a catch to having you on this morning. All right. And so you'll be doing the auctioneering, and will you be emceeing Ringtoberfest as well?
Probably. We're going to have a DJ as well, so there's going to be music in between, and probably we'll have somebody else do some of the auctioneering too, so in case people get tired of listening to one voice. But the other thing I wanted to hit on about the rink itself, the economics of it, the restaurants, the gas stations, the number of people that come to the area because of it can't be overstated. It's a huge driver in the local economy. It really makes a difference.
Yeah, I think on the website it even mentioned how many people, you know, do come to the arena in the course of a month.
Several thousand.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly, but certainly, but there's 3 high school teams that play there, and they'll have to go somewhere else if they have, if they're going to have teams still. So we really need this rink for the high school teams, the hundreds of children that go there, the school groups, and there's some adults that go and play too and have a great time. And it's just such a wholesome activity that the hockey players and their families, they're good people. I mean, if they are willing to get up at 5 in the morning and drive hundreds of miles and put all the work in, those are good people. So yeah. we really need this rink to continue.
And tell people again what the $88,000 is needed for there at the Fenton Chester Arena.
There's a lot of different repairs. Let me pull it up so I know exactly what I'm speaking to here.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, $63,000 is needed for repairs to the Zamboni and the ice making plant. And to cover the initial startup costs, insurance, utilities, and staffing. And we've raised $40,000. So there's and that's just to get it rolling. And we really would like to raise more. Heaven forbid there's if there was a catastrophic problem, the Zamboni, the compressors, or something structural. So we really want to raise more so that we can have a little cushion and not be at risk of if and when something ever took place.
All right. Ringtoberfest will be at the Fenton Chester Arena Saturday, September 25th at 6 o'clock. And if you have items that can be used in the live auction or the silent auction, email mattyoungsells, S-E-L-L-S, at gmail.com. Matt Young is one of the organizers of Ringtoberfest. Sounds like a lot of fun, Matt. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care. We're going to skedaddle now for CBS News. And when we return, we're going to make another stop in the NEK, this time in Brownington at the Old Stonehouse Museum. And it is game time today for the Sox in Detroit. Our coverage begins at 12:10. First pitch in the Motor City at 1:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Listeners, I hope you never grow tired of me being blown away by driving into Vermont's many wonderful small towns and villages and finding something else to gawk over. Rolling into Brownington up in the Kingdom, you experience another of our picturesque Vermont towns, and you're treated to the wonderful Old Stonehouse Museum and Historic Village while you're there. We're going to spend some time there this morning and learn about an event that they've got scheduled for this weekend and about some of their other events coming up the rest of the year. Joining us now to give us a tour and to share the history of the place is their executive director, Molly Vasey. Molly, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have questions about the Old Stonehouse Museum or if you want to share a little about a visit that you made there, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Molly, Brownington isn't necessarily on everyone's destination list. Where is it, and what will people enjoy about visiting the town?
Brownington is spectacular, just by nature, and its visual is arresting. Actually, it's the historic village specifically. Brownington's right smack in the middle of Orleans County, right off the village of Orleans, actually, in Route 5A and 58. So it's not too far off the beaten path. And, of course, Hinman Settler back in the 1800s was really connective tissue between the central part of Vermont and all the way up to the Canadian border. So that's really why the historic village is where it is today, is Hinman Settler was almost like the I-91 of the 1800s. And, of course, then when the actual interstate and the railway came in, that changed the kind of, the dynamic of travel in this area. So we're really not that far off the beaten path, and we love for visitors to come up. And when they do find us, I think that they'll find a confluence of energy that exists here at the historic village, really based in the life and legacy of Alexander Twilight. And, you know, it's definitely palpable, and it deserves a visit.
It does. And tell people what they'll find at the Old Stonehouse Museum and Historic Village.
Sure. So we're a compilation of about 8 historic structures, including Alexander Twilight's home and the dormitory, Athenian Hall, the 4-story granite, beautiful dormitory that he made for his students and finished it in 1836. That is a historic village also includes 2 other homes of old families that relate back to that story and had very much to do with the actual narrative that Alexander Twilight built here around education, and I'll certainly get into more of that too. Mm-hmm. But and then also the grammar school where Alexander Twilight taught, as well as the church where he preached, and the observatory way up on Prospect Hill, which also deserves a specific visit because it's a 360 viewpoint of the entire Northeast Kingdom and into Quebec. It's absolutely stunning up there on a clear day.
That sounds beautiful. Now, have you reopened for in-person tours there at the museum and historic village?
We have. We opened in May for pre-scheduled tours, and then as of Juneteenth, which was our first big kickoff event this year, we opened fully to the public, and we have been since.
What days and hours are you open right now?
We are open from Wednesday to Sunday, and our tours are available from 11 to 4 p.m., leaving at 11, 1, and 3, but we can accommodate walk-ins if there's a tour guide available.
And I hate to talk about the end of the year, but when does the museum and village close for the year so that people know I got to get there soon or I got to get there by a certain date?
Yeah, we always close in the middle a Sunday of October. I believe this year it's October 16th. So you have some time.
All right. That sounds great. Now, describe the Old Stone House.
Sure. So the Old Stone House specifically is the dormitory. So it's Alexander Twilight built it over a span of 3 years, from 1833 to 1836. And he built it, of course, for his to house his many students at the Orleans County Grammar School. It's almost like a college campus back then, if you can visualize that for kids 12 to 18. And so it's an impressive structure. It's really one of the landmarks of this area, and I would really say regionally in the state of Vermont, New England as well. It is outstanding. Its structure has held. It's solid. It's made purely of granite, pretty much. It's got the original plaster inside. It's one of the last remaining dormitories of that era that is really true to form in the interior and hasn't changed too much. So it's really like walking into a time capsule. Mm. It really is,
And what will people find, you know, in the museum and through the village, you know, what will they experience there?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke about this confluence of energy, and I think that's what hits you first. Not to mention, there's something about the will and the strength of spirit that Alexander Twilight still possesses in this place. He really has infused it with kind of an energy. And then also you'll find in the museum, our museum and our collections and our exhibits at this point. So you'll see artifacts from Orleans County history all the way up through the 1800s, from Orleans County families, but also from the era that Alexander Twilight would have taught and kept students in the dormitory. You'll find specific exhibits from towns in our area as well. You'll find exhibits from families that have donated back that were originally families that graduated from the Orleans County Orleans County Grammar School. So there's a lot of fascinating pieces in that building, so many stories to tell, so many wonderful things to share. It's definitely a lot of information and really fun. And a lot of times the kids have the most fun because there's old tools and STEM-related teaching items, so they can really kind of, you know, access the collections in the museum as well.
Now, we've dropped the name Alexander Twilight a bunch so far, so tell people who might not know, who was Alexander Twilight?
Well, Alexander Twilight is certainly the protagonist of our story. He's really the central character through which and on, fundamentally, we've built our mission around at this point. So Alexander Twilight was an African-American, of African-American descent. He was born into a mixed-race household. His father was African-American. His mother was Anglo. He was born in 1795 in Corinth, Vermont. And the family was, you know, strong-willed and persevered, and really that typical Vermont kind of attitude about living in life. Alexander was no different, and he was enrolled at the Orange County Grammar School in Randolph, Vermont, and then in 1821 he entered Middlebury College, and so now he is considered the first person of African American descent to have graduated a United States college in national history. And then after he graduated from Middlebury, he hopped around to a couple of short-term teaching positions and really landed in Brownington in 1829 when he came to teach, be the headmaster and the minister at the Orleans County Grammar School. I've talked about his kind of characteristics, his strength, his stubbornness, his willfulness, but he also was probably a genius. He offered instructions in mathematics, science, language, history, philosophy, theology, multiple different languages, vocal and instrumental music. He used and employed some of the STEM and STEAM, science, technology, engineering, math techniques that right now education is just exploring again. He has a teaching microscope, electrical equipment, a static electricity machine. He was just really, really progressive in education. One of the really coolest things, in my opinion, about his model was that he taught both girls and boys almost equally at the Orleans County Grammar School, and he housed them both simultaneously in the dormitory. The girls' wing was down one level below the boys' wing, and even in one year during his time here, the girls outnumbered the boys in enrollment. So,
Molly, a co-ed dorm back in the 1800s?
Yeah, a co-ed dorm. I know, I didn't even go to college with co-ed dorms. So I think that, you know, in this model of progressive education was absolutely unheard of, but really well appreciated. Obviously, he had huge enrollment, and in his 30-year tenure here in Brownington, in his tenure altogether, he taught almost 3,000 students. So he was clearly an effective educator. Alexander Twilight is somebody who we revere at this organization, and we really, you know, now we're really starting to delve into this idea of how we use his life and legacy and this amazing story to really explore diversity and equity in our rural society and our rural culture, use his story and legacy as a springboard to celebrate other amazing stories of diversity here in our rural region. So, we're facilitating conversations about race and equity through the lens of Alexander Twilight's life.
And didn't he also serve in the State House?
He did, yes. Thanks for bringing that up. The same year that he constructed and finished Athenian Hall, the dormitory, he also was a elected official to the House of Representatives in the state of Vermont, and now he's also considered the first person of African American descent to have been a state official. So he's a man of many firsts, and deserves.
Oh, I think we lost Molly for a moment. We'll try to get her back. All right, Molly, you wriggled off the hook there for a moment, but I'm glad you're back. I want to kind of finish up a little bit with Alexander Twilight. On your website, you post Twilight tidbits, which are bits of his writings. From what you've read of those, what can you tell us about who Alexander Twilight the person was?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yeah, so the Alexander Twilight tidbits come directly from his sermons that he wrote, preached at the Congregational Church right up the road here. And he was, I would describe him, and actually his students describe him as well. He was known for both his strictness, but also his sense of fun. His students unfailingly regarded him with respect and affection, and I think that comes through on many of his sermons. He was also a person of lofty ideals and ideas, and shared that vision with some of his contemporaries in education at the time. His educational pedagogy, as you know, and from the last segment, was incredibly progressive, so some of those traits also shine through in his sermons. One of the most interesting sermons to me is Sermon 14, which really describes his feelings about slavery. And, of course, these were the decades preceding the Civil War. So, you know, when we're exploring this diversity equity work, how did Alexander Twilight feel about slavery? And he definitely condemned slavery, and it was very clearly done so in Sermon 14. He gave Sermon 14 in a number of different places around Orleans County, so he made his opinions well known that slavery was an ill and that should be snuffed out. So he was amongst kind of a crowd of abolitionists here in Orleans County as well. Some of his contemporaries were quite outspoken abolitionists.
Let's go to the phones. Stephen's joining us from Montpelier. You have a question, Stephen?
Yeah, I had heard, and I may be in error, that there may be now or will be a painting of Alexander Twilight in the Vermont State House.
Yes, that's such a great question, Stephen, and I appreciate you bringing it up because it's one of the highlights also of our upcoming event. Our upcoming event is Old Stone House Day on Sunday, August 8th. And it seems, of course, this year, because of that, Stephen is celebrating history, local history, retold through art. And so one of the pieces of that celebration will be the keynote speaker, Katie Rund, who is the portrait artist of Alexander Twilight, commissioned to paint his likeness that will live forever in the Vermont State House, which is really very cool. So that is in progress, and she's a partner of ours, and we're working very closely with her and the history behind Twilight and his personality.
Great question, Stephen. Perfectly placed. Let's talk about what's happening Sunday. I think Pi seems to play a real key part in your special day this Sunday.
Yeah, Pi does play a really special part. It's one of my favorite parts of the day. We kick off the day at 10 o'clock, and it's open to the public. There's a small parking fee, and then the rest of the day is completely free. We start with some music, live music from the Michael Hahn Quartet, and then we have a museum open house, which is totally free of charge, from 10 to 12. Lunch from the Brownington Ladies Aid is right on the green. It's really kind of an old home day. It celebrates our own organizational history. And then we have some more music in the afternoon. But then to get to the pie part, 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. is a silent auction, and then a live auction, auctioning off hand and homemade pies from some of the best bakers in Orleans County. So that'll be fun. We have a live auctioneer, and I get to get up on stage and show everybody these beautiful pies and tell them the descriptions and so forth. And then the afternoon is very much concerned with the annual meeting, and the keynote speaker with Katie Rund, who everybody is welcome to come and listen to as well.
Molly, you sound like you really love your job, and there's so much to it, but the pie, showing off the pies seems to be what you live, you actually took the job for.
It was an appealing part, you're right, and I get my whole family involved. My daughters are always the people who ferry the pie from me to the new owner and so forth.
And this feels like, it feels like one of those special annual events that brings a community and surrounding communities together.
It really does. Yeah, we traditionally, this is the day when the local community really comes together in support of the Old Stone House and to celebrate the Old Stone House. But in recent years, too, we've really had a great showing of people from out of state, visitors, folks who are on Lake Willoughby for vacation, passersby, Canadians, all variety of people, which is really fun to meet new folks as well. So it's a great combination of things for that day.
And pie lovers, of course. Now, let's look at other events. I think this Saturday you have one of our good friends, Howard Coffin, there.
Yes, and that is a free speakers. That's part of our free speaker series, Women in the Civil War, starting at 7 p.m. at the church. And it's completely free of charge, so come on by and hear everything he has to say. No. The Civil War Roundtable in this area is really excited to come and hear him speak. So there's some interest. That's definitely momentum starting here.
He is brilliant when it comes to Civil War history, especially Vermont Civil War history, and he makes it come to life. Even if you're not a Civil War buff, it's really interesting to listen to Howard Coffin.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yep. Now, September 4th, this one sounds magical. It's the Twilight Stars Party.
Yeah, the Twilight Stars Party is really magical. This is also a great event to really engage a large variety, a wide variety of audiences, including young families and young kids, and people of all ages seem to really enjoy it. It's a kind of evening affair. We open the gates somewhere in the range of 4:35. Live music by the Evansville Transit Authority, which is a really popular band up here. They're going to play for a few hours. There's food trucks and drinks and a beer garden, and it's just really fun. Lots of dancing. We usually do some raffles and giveaways. And then at dark, the Fairbanks Museum, led by Bobby Farlese Rubio, comes and does a whole, I mean, just a beautiful tour of the nights of the late summer night sky. And he has his lasers and he has his big telescopes, and you can see the entire sky. It's just beautiful. And it's named, of course, after Alexander Twilight, because the whole thing starts at twilight.
Well, that is perfect. That's September 4th. And we'll stay with Alexander on the 26th. It's his birthday. And so I'm trying to figure out which of these events I love the most, the pie, the stars, or on Alexander Twilight's birthday, it's an apple and cheese festival.
That's a cool one. That was an old one we resurrected because it was so popular. The Apple and Cheese Festival kind of pairs well with Alexander Twilight's birthday, which is on the 23rd, celebrated on that Saturday. And he, you know, he's going to be central to the entire day. So we start the day off with some speakers. Last year we had Congressman Peter Welch and a number of representatives here to do some speaking. We had Bill Hart from Middlebury, a professor emeritus that did a lot of research on Alexander Twilight. We just had a really wonderful event. That was the first event we've had for commemorating his birthday. And then this year we're adding in that apple and cheese piece, which always happens in the fall. And there's going to be artisan cheese drinks, wines, ciders, artisan beverages, breads, vendors of all kinds, and that will be a really fun day. Yeah.
Now, another thing I'd love for you to talk about is something you have there at the Village are the blacksmithing classes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the blacksmithing classes are really popular. Our blacksmither Courtney Mead is also a farrier by trade, and he's just an artist. He really is. He brings students through the entire process from beginner all the way up to Open Forge, which is when he invites students back to just play and work in the forge under his tutelage. So he really does the whole gamut. There's a couple of different pieces available through the summer and into the fall, which is beginner blacksmithing. It's called Taste of Blacksmithing. And then after you kind of, you know, graduate from that stage, you're welcome back to the Open Forge anytime. So there's a really vibrant community of blacksmithing students that have kind of graduated and continue to keep coming back. So it's a really wonderful part of what we can provide here.
And Molly, is the summer raffle still going on there?
The summer raffle is until October. Beautiful handmade quilts by one of our community members, Lois Barrows, and another gorgeous braided rug from Mary Ragno, who's one of our advisors and community members. And then we have a smattering of bagged goodies, including some homemade jam and a wonderful book about the kingdom and all the different places to hit if you come.
All right. And let's tell people one more time about what's going on this Sunday and, you know, what the times are, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So Sunday, August 8th, Old Stone House Day, an annual meeting starting at 10. The whole day goes from 10 to 4. There's multiple different pieces of that, including the pie auction and live music and open house of the Old Stone House and vendors and food and all kinds of fun things, interactive things for kids games. We think we might be able to do some horse and carriage rides up to Prospect Hill. So lots of different things to look forward to. And then at 2 o'clock, Katie Rundy, the portrait artist for the Vermont State House, will speak, and then we'll commence the annual meeting right after that. So I do hope people come out and join us for that day. It's going to be a really fun event.
And pies will be presented by Molly Vasey all day Sunday. Be very careful with those pies, Molly.
Yeah, I will.
All right. Molly Vasey is the executive director of the Old Stonehouse Museum and Historic Village in Brownington. You can learn more about the museum by visiting oldstonehousemuseum.org. Molly, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, take care. It was our pleasure. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back to hear about the Brushbrook Community Farm in Huntington. And a reminder that coming up today at 11, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We've been hanging in the NEK for the past hour, which is always great. Now let's head to a farm in Huntington, where they're doing things a little differently. It's called the Brushbrook Community Farm and Bakery, and it's part of something called the Agricultural Gift Economy. Joining us now to tell us about the farm and bakery and explain what the gift economy is Adam Wilson. Adam, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for your interest in inviting me on the show.
You're welcome, Adam. Listeners, to ask Adam about the farm or to let us know if you've had some of their delicious bread, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Adam, what is the Brushbrook Community Farm and Bakery?
Well, before I get started, I should rightly say thanks to all those who've allowed me to be around long enough to have a few stories to tell. And the farm really itself is a story, and so maybe starting with how we began might be fitting.
Okay.
So we sensed ourselves to be on the receiving end of quite a lot of generosity, and so decided to throw parties or host a feast for the town and invite everyone in town. We called it a gratitude feast, and roasted a lamb and cooked up a whole lot of vegetables and baked fresh bread and served that at the town hall in Huntington. And one of the guests, to our surprise and pleasure, was Enid Wanacott, who was the director of NOFA Vermont.
Yeah.
For 30 years, and she was quite sick at that point. She died shortly afterwards of cancer, and she'd overseen a lot of what we know as the organic farming movement in the state. And she took me aside after the meal and said, "You know, Adam, that was really great. We'd fed about 125 people and celebrated local food." And she said, "That was really great, but it would be better if you had a dance afterwards." And so it took me a little while to understand what she was saying, but what I understood her to be advising me on is, Adam, don't remember, or please remember that agriculture has the word culture in it, and tend to the culture work as you would the soil under your feet. And so we hosted quite a few feasts, including a dance for Enid afterwards over the following winter, and then were greeted by the pandemic and switched to giving food away at an outdoor stand every week, which we've done since last April.
When was that gratitude feast, and when did Brushbrook Community Farm and Bakery get started?
Let's see. Well, I used to sell bread under the name Running Stone Bread, and then it was at the beginning of the pandemic that all bread sales ceased, and all the bread, in addition to the other foods that we grow and glean, were given away.
Now, give us an idea of the grounds of the farm, what you have there, what goes on at the farm.
So one thing that's a bit unique about the farm is that we don't own any property. We work with quite a few landowners around town to really try to put underutilized land, buildings, skills, people's skills and energies to use. And that's a central practice of the farm is gleaning. So we graze sheep and cows all around town on unused fields, and so we think of them as gleaning that grass that would otherwise be mowed, just to keep the fields open, and they're preserving that food that we can then feed people. And so one of the main foods we give away right now is soup every week, and we, of course, boil the bones down from the animals to make the broth for the soups.
Mm-hmm. There are great photos on your website, too, seeing those sheep moving around Huntington. It's a beautiful thing. How about the bakery? What kinds of things do you make at the bakery there?
In the bakery, that's one area where we do purchase ingredients. So we buy wheat and rye and corn from three Vermont farms and grind that into fresh flour and bake bread. And that's all given away at the stand as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brushbrook has this very special mission. So tell us about it, Adam.
Well, let's see. One way to maybe describe a bit of what we do and why we do it. You know, that the question of what we do is interesting, but it's always, for me, interesting to say why would we do what we do. And there is a quote that I've used before that seems quite fitting and helpful in terms of understanding why we would put so much energy into giving food away as gifts. Poet and author and elder Wendell Berry wrote a quote that came into my hands shortly before that first gratitude feast. And he writes, "We seem to have forgotten that there once were or ever could be mutually sustaining relationships between resident humans and their home places. Absent such relationships, we have become the willing parasites of any and every place, destroying the source and substance of our lives as parasites invariably do." And it's quite a collection of words there, and mm-hmm. I know you're the one asking the questions, Rick, but I wonder if I might ask a question. What do words like that do to you, or what do they stir in you when you hear them?
Well, when I hear the word parasite a couple times, you know, it really shakes me a bit, has me mm-hmm. concerned about what we're doing here.
Yeah. I'd say it shook us pretty good. It shook me. Stings a little bit, even. Mm-hmm. To hear words like that, and perhaps elicits a bit of sorrow or grief, and I'd say that's one of the guiding lights of the farm, is to stay with that sorrow, stay with that grief, and imagine how we might proceed in the presence of that and how we might proceed differently.
Now, the mission is wrapped in something called the agricultural gift economy. What exactly is that? Explain that to us.
Sure. So, I mean, in most simple terms, we do not sell anything. That any of the foods that we produce or harvest, glean, are given to, that we process, turn into soups and bread currently, we do not sell. We give them all away as gifts. And on every one of the labels on the quart of soup or a loaf of bread that leaves the farm, it says, "This food is offered as a gift to anyone who is hungry for any reason." And that language is chosen specifically or with intention. And, you know, when you give food away, you're often pegged as a charity organization. And I think for a lot of people, that's the assumption of the energy behind what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always said, who am I to decide who really needs the food? And often we are asked, how do you make sure the food gets to those who really need it? And the short answer is we don't. We don't assume who needs it. We say it's offered to anyone who's hungry for any reason. And I always tell people I usually get hungry at least twice a day, so that would include me most days. And we just have a stand out, and anyone who wants to come pick up food comes to pick up food. And we make a monthly budget available to the public,
mm-hmm.
and thus far for 16 months our budget has been met by various people chipping in to cover that budget.
Wow. I mean, there are costs that are associated with the farm, the bakery. I mean, sadly, this is a fact of life for all of us, Adam. So how is this a sustainable way to keep what you're doing going and operating?
You know, the fact that it has been sustained is really all I could could speak to, that people have responded to what really is not a plan, and I think that that confuses people when they ask if what we're doing, we think it's going to work out, and we say, well, there's no way that it could work out because we didn't ever have a plan. We just instead understand the work to be a plea that what we were doing and what we are doing societally, ecologically, isn't working all that well and hasn't been working all that well and perhaps is getting worse. And maybe we together could imagine another way to interact with other humans, human to human, as well as human to all that is not human. And there is another way to describe the work of the farm, you know, in responding to that question, how are we going to make sure the food gets to the people who really need it most? It took me quite a while to figure out how to answer that question, and even longer to screw up the courage to publish it in the farm's newsletter, weekly newsletter that goes out. But I finally did, and wondered if anyone would keep showing up, and to my surprise, they did. And here's what I wrote, which is, the work of the farm is not to help poor people get rich, but rather to invite rich people to consider voluntary impoverishment as a moral, even a joyful choice in a time of cascading ecological and social troubles. And I know that's an earful, but that's maybe a little bit more honest explanation of the deep passion that goes into the work carried on by folks on the farm team and a lot of community members who chip in every week to harvest and care for the animals and process food and give it away.
Adam, you've mentioned in the past so many kind and miraculous things happening there at the farm. Can you give us an example or two of that?
Well, sure. So at our gratitude feasts, we were blessed to have the two oldest residents of the town attend. They once they got onto them, they and had rides secured. They were there at every feast. And Florence Miles milked cows in town for all of her working years and had quite a few stories to tell. And Ted Sargent, the second oldest resident of the town at 92, at the final feast, which was just a few days before the pandemic was announced, Florence and Ted, both widowed, got up and did a waltz together. Wow. And you can imagine that that was quite a thing to be in the presence of.
Yeah, wow, that is magical. You mentioned that this got started, you know, just as the pandemic started. So how was that, getting Brushbrook Community Farm up, running? Were you able to still provide food for people during all that?
Yes. Yeah, so the move to giving food away out at an outdoor stand seemed like the way to do that. And really through the pandemic, the people coming each week to the stand, you know, carefully maintaining distance and all that, for a lot of people was some of their only human contact each week, and so that was quite meaningful to be able to offer that. And we were able to continue to give food away outdoors through the winter by utilizing an unheated greenhouse and switching the distribution to Saturdays during the day and crossing our fingers and for some sun to warm up the greenhouse. And didn't have to miss a week. So
Now there's no charge for the food, for the soup and the bread. When people come and pick it up, you don't charge, you don't ask for any donations, but there is, I think, a mailbox across the street somewhere that if right. If people feel so moved, they can make a gift.
You know, quite a few interesting things happen with that. So when people are coming to the stand for the first time, often they'll already have their wallet out and have pulled a couple of bills out of their wallet just to show us that they're ready to pay. And we'll say, please, you know, please receive the food. The food is offered as a gift. There is no price. They'll often ask, well, how much would it be if you were to sell it in the store? And we'll say, well, again, the food's offered as a gift. If you'd like to leave a gift, there is a mailbox out there in the parking lot. And it's quite interesting that often people will feel the need to say to us, well, I'm going to go put money in that box. And there's a lot to wonder about our the discomfort that arises from receiving a gift and the person you received it from not knowing if you've squared up, so to speak. And so I think a lot of it is a bit of a social experiment to see how people respond. And people have responded in quite miraculous ways. People are involved with the project by tending to the website, bookkeeping, offering their skills in welding or sawing lumber from their sawmills. You know, we receive quite a few gifts, and only some of them are money. Luckily, enough people's gift to give is money that they cover the budget, and then others have quite unique and amazing gifts to give. The musicians who play music at the distributions, all of that.
Hmm. People who have come there say that they get a lot more than food when they pick it up there. What are they getting?
Well, you know, we did decide to use the word community in the name of the farm. It is Brushbrook Community Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that word community can be a bit of a slippery idea these days, you know, what is a community really? But in a most simple way, just gathering is what we do. We invite people to gather, and we invite people to consider imagining what relationships of repair might be. And, you know, when we say this food's offered as a gift to anyone who's hungry for any reason, I've noticed that there's a lot of hunger out there that has little to do with insufficient calories in the fridge.
Tell people again when the bread and soup is available.
Sure. So the schedule is always on our website, and it's always updated. This coming Friday is a soup and bread distribution. It's 4 to 6 on Fridays, and the address is right there on the website on the main road in Huntington.
And explain what the day is like when people show up and receive their bread and soup.
Oh, it's generally a steady flow of folks during that time, and quite a few who we've grown fond of. So you can imagine it's a joyful time for us to see our neighbors and often their kids, and for them, if the animals are grazing nearby, to visit with the animals. Right now, the sheep and cows are both groups are grazing right near the home farm. So,
we also do
host a weekly work day on Sundays, and that's from 1 to 4, and that's an opportunity for folks to come and help with the various labors that sustain the farm, and information on that is always on the website and in the farm's newsletter.
Yeah, tell people about volunteering there at the farm, what kind of help you could use, and welcome.
Sure. Well, the work days are our weekly organized way for people to plug in, where the whole farm team is there. There are six of us who run the farm together. Those are the folks that we call the farm team, of which I'm one. And we host those work days and try to match people with projects that seem like a good fit and introduce them to some of the activities that we do to tend to the pastures, the pantry, the gardens. And we also make soup during that time, so people are can help to wash and chop vegetables and prepare ingredients for the soups.
The farm has sheep, has cows. Do you raise vegetables as well? What kind?
We do, yes. A wide diversity of vegetables, and we also do a lot of gleaning, so we have various other local farms who, when they have things that would otherwise go to waste, they let us know, and we'll go and pick them up and preserve and process and make sure they get used.
Is there a point, Adam, where there won't be any expenses on the farm?
That's a good question. So the budget, which is available on the website currently, is around just a little under $5,000, I believe, per month, which is quite a small amount, I would say, for we have three of us who are full-time, so to speak, meaning we give our energies most exclusively to the project, and then three more who are some level of part-time. And because so much of what goes into the food, to produce the food that we give away, is given as a gift. So, for example, all the landowners who offer their land offer that as a gift. Building materials for the cow barn that we built last fall were all given as a gift. It allows us to keep the expenses quite low. And whether we can replace some of those things that we still have to purchase with money over time by building even, you know, further relationships will be, you know, that'll be something to see.
And as Adam has mentioned several times, the budget is on the website. The website address, brushbrookcommunityfarm.org. You look at the monthly newsletter, and it is broken out with line items to explain the expenses and the incomes. So it is very transparent if you want to take a look at that. We've been speaking with Adam Wilson of the Brushbrook Community Farm and Bakery. And again, the website address is brushbrookcommunityfarm.org. Adam, it was great learning about what you're doing there. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks again for your interest, Rick.
All right. Have a great day. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please keep those suggestions of topics and guests coming. Love hearing from you. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.